Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is microphone man David Bach. But first of all, are the Grammys out of touch? Well, a lot of artists think so. Many huge stars that were nominated this year passed on the show. Drake, Justin Bieber, Kanye West, just to name a few, and many didn't even submit their works for the Academy this year, which is mind-boggling. Like Frank Ocean, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, they just didn't think it was worth it to even submit their last album. Well, why is this happening? For many in the music business, they think that the Grammys really don't connect with the younger audience, but this has been going on for at least 50 years. Every Grammy broadcast, this is what you hear. The problem is, it's a fine line for the producers of the TV show. Because first of all, what they're really trying to do is broadcast some entertainment, not necessarily music, but entertainment. And they're up against some very stiff competition. As a matter of fact, the ratings have been going down for 4 or 5 years now, which is not a good sign. And considering that NARIS makes the majority of their money from the Grammy broadcast, they're very, very keen on getting the best ratings possible. So when it comes down to it, younger people don't really watch television that much, and they have to cater to the people that do. And that's one of the reasons why you really don't see acts that are very youth-oriented. I mean, there are some for sure, but it's not as drastic as a lot of people would like. The Grammys are doing their best, though, because now they're actually taking streaming releases into consideration, where previous years they didn't do that. I understand where they're coming from. It's not an easy thing to do. There's a fine line between getting ratings, being entertaining, and pleasing your core audience. So good luck to everybody at the Grammys for what they're doing. I've had my criticisms of them over the years, but again, they're kind of in a tough place. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The fourth editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, the Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. Now in 2017, there's actually a couple milestones that are happening. It's the 50th anniversary of both SIR and Clare Brothers. So SIR, of course, has been the giant rehearsal conglomerate that has 13 facilities in just about the biggest markets of the country. And that's the one place you go if you're a signed act and you're about to go out on the road, you go to SIR. Well, why? Well, first of all, they have just about anything you can think of in terms of PA and backline, so you don't have to bring your own if you don't want to. It's very, very easy. The other thing is they have rehearsal studios that are kind of set up like mini concert halls. So it's actually better for an act before they go out on the road to go there, even though it's more expensive than a normal rehearsal facility. But then again, a normal rehearsal facility doesn't have the accommodations to be able to work with a bigger star. For instance, the security, which is very, very tight at SIR, as well as some of the star amenities like dressing rooms and bars and things like that. So we all know what it's like to be looking for a rehearsal room, and in many cases, they're difficult to find in any shape or form. But just imagine now, if you're a star, or if you're about to go out on the road, even as an opening act, you have to go one level above rehearsal halls, and that's why you go to SIR. Now, speaking of which, Clare Brothers, the biggest PA company in the world, is also celebrating their 50th anniversary. Clare Brothers comes from Lititz, Pennsylvania. They're right down the road from where I grew up. As a matter of fact, my band used to buy their used gear, and I would always hang out down there and was always amazed at just how large a facility was, and this is way, way back. In 1967, the Clare Brothers, Roy and Gene Clare, got their break with the Four Seasons, and they took their A7s, Altec Lansing A7s, Voice of the Theaters, they're basically theater speakers, and they took them out on the road with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, and of course, this went a step above what everybody was used to, and Clare Brothers was on their way. Now, not only do they have facilities all over the country, all over the world, really, but they also build their own products. They also do installs in just about any facility you can think of. And they have Rock Lititz, which is one of the biggest purpose-built rehearsal halls in the United States. And what this is it's a giant facility, basically the size of a concert hall. The reason why is so many times before a major act goes out on the road, they want to test their full production out. And the only way they can do that is to rent out a major venue or to go to a place like Rock Lititz. And Rock Lititz can actually accommodate a full production of just about any act you can think of. So Clare Brothers has come a long way in 50 years, as has SIR. Quick story about how SIR got started. It's pretty interesting, actually. Their first rental was a bass for a session. And the fact of the matter is they didn't even own the bass. The founders went and rented it from a music store and then re-rented it to the client. And that started off 50 years of renting out backline and renting out rehearsal facilities. So congratulations to SIR and Clare Brothers. David Bach began repairing microphones when he worked as a tech at the Hit Factory and then later on at Oceanway Audio. He eventually launched Sound Deluxe Microphones as a division of the Hollywood Post Production Company, then started his own Bach Microphones when Sound Deluxe was acquired. David knows more about microphones than most people on the planet, even going as far as learning how to read German just so he can read old Neumann technical manuals. He makes more than clones of vintage classic mics, because in many ways they're better. I spoke with David in his test room at Bach Microphones in North Hollywood, California. I'm curious, what got you interested in microphones to begin with?
Really, it goes back to when I was first in college, and I worked in the electronic music department. And one of the jobs I had was to record everything in the recital hall at college. And we had a couple of microphones, an Electrovoice 666.
Oh, boy.
And a Neumann SM2 and a pair of Neumann SM or M269s. And I had recorded many concerts, and I sat down with the microphones and a pair of headphones in the shop one day, which I had never done before. I said, and I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. It sounds better than reality. So at that moment, I was always interested in microphones.
Mm-hmm. But professionally, though, I know you were fixing microphones for a long time. So how did that happen? Because, you know, a lot of people, even if they have the technical expertise, you know, they want to stay away from that. It just seems like it's taboo to get into that. So
yes, and it was very much, I think that was even more so when I started as an engineer in about 1984, really, in San Francisco. And at the time, I knew how to solder, and I had built plenty of things, but I didn't really have the technical expertise to get inside a microphone. And in a way, there's an upside to that, is that when I was doing sessions as an engineer, I would just listen to the microphone. I have no idea what circuits are involved, and this sounds good, that sounds bad. And so my determinations then were made without prejudice of knowledge of any electrical behavior. Mm-hmm. And there was a technician there, Gary Kreiman, and he was also an engineer, and he taught me how to not be afraid of opening a microphone up and how to not destroy it while you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And get some basic repairs done. And after that, it was, even though I had worked at Hit Factory, we didn't do a lot of work on microphones back in the late 80s. Those were mostly rentals. So it wasn't until I got to Oceanway where I got to work on a lot of mics.
Okay, when you say basic repairs, what does that mean?
That means not being afraid to open it up and see if there's a broken wire.
Yeah.
Because when you're working on an M49 from 1955, there's a high probability that it's as simple as that.
Okay. So you never really got involved with cleaning diaphragms or anything like that, which I know is not a good thing, but
well,
generally speaking.
I did get to doing that, yeah, back in the 80s. And now we recommend new membranes. It's just safer. But
yeah.
In some cases, you might want to clean. Now, the reason to not clean is that it turns out there's generally a lot of microscopic perforations of the membrane.
Mm.
And if you don't have a microscope, you won't know that. And if you don't dismount the membrane and you clean it, you're going to introduce potentially introduce a liquid where it shouldn't be introduced.
Liquid?
You not uncommon to clean a membrane with
deionized
water.
Yeah.
If there's a perforation in the membrane, you're going to get the liquid in the rest of the capsule where it shouldn't be.
I get it. Okay, so then you got the ocean way, and of course, Alan has a huge or had a huge mic locker.
Biggest one in the world at the time. Been surpassed by McBride now.
Was that one of your jobs then to take care of the microphones, or that just kind of happened by osmosis?
No, it was something that either Bruce or I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to work at Ocean Way, you had to be fluent in everything. It was like you had to speak 10 languages or you weren't even considered for the job.
So, yeah.
That was just normal for us to do there.
How did you make the jump into making your own microphones? Because that's quite a jump, quite a leap.
I met a guy one day, and I pitched an idea, and he loved it, and we started a company.
Sound Deluxe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wiley Stateman had started Sound Deluxe, the post-production company, and he'd already been nominated for 2 Oscars by the time I met him. And they were expanding their businesses. They had a lot of different business ventures, and this was seemed like a great idea for him, to him. So.
Was it a personal thing? It's like, we don't like the mics we have. We want to use some new ones. Or was it just a business venture, or was it something that they wanted to actively use?
Wiley absolutely loves microphones. He has a collection, and so it was a way for him to be able to experiment with microphones that he could use. And he saw that I had a vision of, well, look, I want to outfit my studio, but I can't really afford what I'm used to.
Yeah.
And I'm used to the best. So there's got to be a way we can do that without spending that kind of money. And that's really the idea.
How long did it take until you got your first one together? What was the vision for your first microphone?
Well, it seems completely arrogant looking back, but the idea was to take what Neumann had done classically and maybe best it. And so looking at it with very inexperienced, I mean, I'd say that now that I was inexperienced at the time for sure compared to now because I've been building microphones for 21 years. But I looked at a lot of simple factors and said, oh, look, they did this. We can increase the polarization voltage on the membrane. We can do this. We can do that. We can fix all the mistakes they made. And it led to, I mean, the U95 was the first product that we made, which was nominated for a tech award.
Yeah.
Which was, I looking at it now, kind of unusual to get nominated your first time out.
Yeah.
So the idea was to, wherever I could improve it, I would improve on what was known as a classic microphone without completely departing from it.
Okay, so when you looked at those improvements, or what you thought was improvements,
yes.
Did Neumann put those inadequacies there for a reason, or was it just poor engineering or not knowing enough at the
time? Well, it turns out that there's no such thing as poor engineering in Neumann, especially from the 50s. And it turns out that there's nothing by accident in all of what Neumann did in the 50s and the early 60s. So things that you could look at and say, oh, this is a inadequacy, was actually done very much on purpose. Now, the purpose is, in many cases, that there was a requirement of German broadcast, which was their primary customer, or that there was a requirement of this product needs to work in 120 countries. And we're going to make it so that it can get shipped and dropped and it's still going to work.
Yeah.
And so that's a value unto itself, which turns out might be worthwhile to have.
Yeah, no kidding.
But as an inexperienced person, I couldn't see that at the time.
You felt that, and I know you learned German so you could read the manual. So is that about the time that this happened?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I assume that you looked at the circuits and thought, wait a second, there's something here that I can't figure out, so you wouldn't go to the manual. Is that what happened?
There's that. There's also, there are many details that what's important about microphones is detail of execution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons you don't see a ton of patents. There's not a lot of literature on what actually drives products. So for example, in the patent where Neumann talks about the U67, they talk about the use of positive feedback to create a very specific high pass filter, which is really a rumble filter, which had nobody had done before. So the patent is an excellent explanation of this very complicated filter. But that's actually not the other main things that happened with that microphone. There was a capsule innovation, there was a amplifier feedback innovation, and there was a amplifier frequency control innovation on the high frequency. All those three other points that actually create the signature of what a U67 sounds like were ignored by the patent. So so there's not a lot of literature available for what is really the secret behind any great microphone.
Okay.
And it's essentially trade secrets.
Yeah.
So it's either known by somebody older at the company, or it's written down, or it's been shredded. And that's true for the majority of microphone products. It's just internal information.
That's unbelievable. So it makes me think that people that go and copy a microphone, a vintage microphone especially, and lots of boutique manufacturers are doing this, it's hard for them to get it right. I mean, parts aside, because you can't, you know, yes, a lot of parts you can't get, but it sounds like they're just copying it without knowing what's behind it.
I'm guilty of having done that, and only having done that did I realize over time and continuous examination that there was more detail than what just a schematic reveals.
Yeah.
So on a schematic, you see some sawtooth lines, and you see some plates next to each other, and you think resistor, capacitor, but not all capacitors are made the same way. And you see a drawing for a capsule, but we could make a K47 capsule 10 different ways, and you would identify them all as different, but they would all measure as in the family of K47s.
Wow.
Just because, and if we change some of the different tolerances of the holes in the backplate, it would change entirely what the sound is. If we change the material of the backplate itself, that will change the sound too. So it's all about all of these details, none of which are written down.
Wow. And how did you figure it out? Oh, well, okay. Let me back
up. You're sitting in the room that helped me do that.
Okay. Your own chamber. Yeah. Okay. I get it. But let's back up for a second. So if you look at whatever the vintage microphones are, they change through the years. Which one do you identify as the best one? And then you have to get a good version. How do you know if you have the best version of what's available?
Yeah, and that was more of a problem when I was first started doing this. And the first real replica mic that we did was the 251. And in one of those attempts to uncover the puzzle that was a 251, I rented, I think, from a local company here in Hollywood, I think they had like eight of them, and I rented eight 251s. And wow, they were all different, and I couldn't help myself. I opened them all up, and hey, they were all different inside.
Wow.
Every one of them. So at that point, I said, there is no standard for a 251. They come in a they do fall into a family, we just have to kind of create an average of that.
What was the reason why they were all different?
There were many repairs and modifications that had been done over time. From what I can tell, even if repairs and modifications weren't done on, let's say, a pair of KM54s, and let's say that the parts haven't aged poorly, they still are not likely to sound the same. In all my years of repairing mics, I've come across, for example, I've never come across a pair of KM54s that were really a pair. I've never seen it. But I did come across one C24, which was an older one that belonged to Steve Vai, where not only were the top capsules matched to each other, but the fronts and backs were matched.
Wow.
This was completely bone stock. I've never seen it before or since.
Wow.
So it's an example of, you know, it happened once at the factory, but
yeah. There's so many boutique manufacturers, microphone manufacturers, and more keep popping up every show.
That's true.
And at all different price points. What is the difference between the boutique manufacturers, and I assume that there's a bunch of them, especially the newer ones, that wouldn't have your expertise or manufacturing capabilities, experience. So what is the general difference between boutique microphone manufacturers?
Well, it seems to be different permutations of circuitries and OEM capsules and power supplies, if we're talking about tube mics.
Mm-hmm.
So I recently did a study where I obtained all of the current U47 clones on the market, and some of them came really close but did not get all the way, and some of them came really close but still did not get all the way, and some of them were way off the mark. In that case, for specifically U47, you've got a couple of vendors who are all buying their bodies from the same place. And some of them, furthermore, some of them are getting their capsules in the same place.
Yeah.
They might have a different tube or a slightly different circuit, and they all had different power supplies for sure.
How much of a difference does the power supply make, or how important is the power supply to the microphone?
In a simple triode or a pento run as a triode, the power supply is the circuit. It is not an accessory. It's in the signal path. It's completely in the signal path.
Wow.
In that type of, yeah.
Yeah.
You can build circuitry that eliminates power supply from the circuit, but that's not what any of these mics are. So the power supply has everything to do with what the mic's going to sound like.
So cheap power supply, not the sound then.
Yeah, and it doesn't take you don't have to be a golden ear to hear this. You could do the experiment. Anybody could do this experiment. Take a Sony C800G with it's got a great power supply. Take that and then build a similar power supply with and change the B+ transformer. And you will change the sound of the mic.
Hmm. If you had to pick the most important part of a microphone, what would it be?
Unfortunately, they're so complex that they really are an addition. It's a sum of all of the parts. So I've seen cases where, I saw one case where somebody put Chinese K67s in a pair of vintage U47s. But it still had a similarity of, there's some similarity of tone to what those sounded like, because everything else, the power supplies and the microphones, were original. So there was a certain similarity of tone, even if it was the frequency response was different.
Okay, well, I'm glad you brought that up then. So the difference between the tubes you can get today and what was used in the past, way different, obviously.
Yes, in many ways, and maybe that's the only way I wish it was 1955 again.
Yeah, yeah. I keep on reading the rumors that there's going to be a new tube plant opening up in the United States, and it's basically because of a project by DARPA.
We know that vacuum tubes are able to withstand EMPs, so...
It's not that. It's because of the power and it basically wouldn't be the same kind of tubes. It'd be power tubes that they're doing.
But, yeah. People rebuild power tubes for transmitters.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that still exists. That's still something you might do if you owned a radio station.
I had no idea that they could be rebuilt.
Yeah, it has not all gone solid state yet.
Yeah. Well, that I knew. I just didn't know you could do that to a tube.
Yeah. Well, if it's large enough.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know what that means for us in audio, because we were really lucked out. We had the benefit of the a giant military and a giant entertainment industry that consumed millions of tubes.
Yeah.
And you think about somebody wanted to start a TV company, like selling you television receivers that might have 50 tubes in it. It had to go get to your house, and it had to work.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't have unreliable tubes in that thing.
Yeah.
Because nobody would buy TVs from you then.
Yeah. What kind of tubes do you use?
We use new old stock tubes.
Yeah, okay. Where do you find them? Because it must be more and more difficult all the time.
Not necessarily. In terms of onesie twosies, for some really popular tube types like a 6072 or an EF86, I might use on a guitar amp, you can go to eBay and I haven't bought a bad one yet. Maybe not microphone qualified, but most sellers have no idea what that is anyway.
Yeah, right.
But there's a lot of reliable sellers, and all of a sudden the internet seems to have opened up that market for people. So in some senses, obtaining an AC701 or a 6072 or an EF86, it's actually a little easier now than it was 20 years ago. But buying thousands and hundreds is more difficult.
Yeah, I guess the vendors are more readily visible
now
than they were. How do you qualify the tubes for your mics then? Microphone quality.
Over in the next room, which I'll show you on the way out, there's a burn-in rack where the tubes that I've already tested get burned in for a specific amount of time so that they can then get retested and then go into a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And the test is really simple. You just, we build a dummy capsule circuit, and the tube either passes or fails parameters. If we didn't have a golden standard tube or microphones that people have accepted as this is quiet enough for me, then we wouldn't know what to do, but we have those things. So we know the parameters of how bad you can push it before it's unacceptable.
How long could you reasonably expect the tube to last?
Well, there are VF-14s that are still functional and have been, even ones that, some that get noisy can get regenerated now. You blow all the, use a high voltage to blow all the stuff off the cathode, and they can have a second life.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. That's part of the reason I think I have bins and bins of old tubes that aren't good, but I haven't thrown out.
Mm-hmm. You don't have many microphone products. It's four, right, that I know of? There's three in the Sound Deluxe.
Yeah.
USA. Well, yeah. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
There's four Box and one Sound Deluxe, and one Sound Deluxe about to be released in about 4 weeks.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. How do you decide what microphones that you should build, you should sell?
Well, we had there is some legacy where we know that people, they like known quantities. So not everybody who wants a U47 really is ready to spend $16,000 or $18,000. And they are willing to spend $5,000 and try ours, and or less, and try somebody else's. And so that's already very well, at this point, really established in the marketplace. A 47, a 251, these are things that we sell all the time because there's this constant demand.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like boutique amp replica companies, or even 1959 Les Paul replica companies. Not everybody has $325,000 to buy that 1959 Les Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
But they might put down $5,000 for a really great copy.
Yeah.
So it sort of creates a bigger market for itself. Just when you think that market's going to saturate, it gets bigger.
What is the market for your FET 47 version? And the reason why I say that is, there's FET 47s that you see in a lot of bigger studios, especially, but it's not like they're buying a lot of them. You know, you'll see one in every studio, but
sometimes two.
Yeah, sometimes two. So I'm just wondering, and I know there's a demand for it, but I'm just wondering, how big is it? Am I underestimating it?
No, not at all. The part of what we did is we didn't build a replica, so. Ours actually has more low frequency headroom, and it has two amplifiers in it. So you're not stuck with the low sensitivity, high SPL capable U47 FET, which is, it's a very clinical, cold sounding mic.
Mm-hmm.
We have a separate circuit that you can switch in. That is a simple class A circuit. So you get the K47 capsule with a simpler amplifier that's not clinical, and a lot of people use that for vocals.
That's brilliant.
because the capsule's the same. It's just you have different applications that have different demands. There's no reason that we couldn't allow for that.
Okay, well, let's talk about Sound Deluxe USA, because that's new.
Yes.
First of all, let's go back to, you're doing Sound Deluxe mics, and then did you go off on your own before Sound Deluxe was acquired? Or
well,
was this,
Sound Deluxe was and Sound Deluxe Microphones and Todd AO had been part of a larger corporate buyout that ultimately at one point fed up to AT&T. And so I did work for AT&T for 6 months.
Wow. Apparently. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's how big it got. And as part of this corporate this and thattery, in 2006, Microphones and a couple of other profitable businesses were shut down. And I had been negotiating to buy Sound Deluxe Microphones because I just didn't understand how it fit into their giant corporate model. We weren't a phone company. We weren't an internet satellite provider. We weren't going to be. So I didn't understand. And I wanted to just take it out of there so we'd have a little more freedom to do what we wanted to do, not even though they didn't impart any product requirements on us. Anyway, it got shut down. I didn't get to buy it, and I started my own company. And so that's why I started Bach. And ultimately...
Better branding anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ultimately, Sound Deluxe went out of business as a post-production company. And soon after that, we wanted to... I had been searching for a second label where I could do products made in the same shop, not necessarily made to cost no object performance as the only goal, like Bach was, but a second label where I could have cost as a consideration, but still the fundamental values of the product.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to register the Sound Deluxe USA trademark, and I brought back the U195 first. Mm-hmm.
What's the next one that's coming out?
The U99.
Ah, yeah.
And it's a different version of the U99 because there's a feature set now. You've got a lot more high-frequency controls on the mic.
That's cool.
User switchable.
What's the price point?
$24.99.
Mm. Very cool.
Yeah.
So what would be the difference then from Bach and Sound Deluxe? Would it be less QC, different parts? What's the major difference, would you say?
Primarily, it's using an Asian capsule instead of a German capsule.
Ah, okay.
That's the main difference, but everything else is the same or similar.
I didn't realize you're getting German capsules. Are they like Neumann capsules? Or
we don't buy Neumann capsules, no. They don't sell capsules to anybody. But our vendor has been our vendor in Germany for a long time.
Uh-huh.
So our capsules are exclusive to our products in the U.S.
But they're German.
But they are German, and I was just there to see how things were going. And that's part of why our products do sound unique, even if you compare them to other similarly priced competitive products.
Considering that I'm sure there's a lot of parts that are no longer made or no longer made the same way.
Unobtainium.
Oh, there you go, right. Do you have to get a lot of custom parts made?
We do have custom parts made, and we also we're always hunting for treasure chests of new old stock parts. So that includes vacuum tubes or resistors or capacitors that were made well. But there are some modern things that are made nicely, like you can get great wire now. You can get great transformers now. And power transformers tend to be toroidal now, but if you specify them properly, they'll sound as good as an old power transformer. New connectors, not really a problem. Connectors, we can get threaded connectors now that are just as wonderful as the connectors from the old days, really. So we're not, and because everything we do is not a clone, we're not restricted by having to duplicate things as they originally were, like the plastic frame of a 251 that by definition has to crumble eventually.
Yeah.
It has to crack. We don't have to do that. Our frames are metal. And in that mic, I designed our own switch. That's a custom part. Yeah, so we had to get a mold and have somebody make... we have to have somebody mold that plastic for us, mm-hmm. but it is ours. And designing that switch the way we did it, we were able to pass the savings on to the customer because the original switch is very complicated mm-hmm. and is very expensive to produce. So in a lot of ways, we're not completely hindered by what we can get nowadays. Although it does seem like there is a push to get rid of through-hole components from manufacturers of resistors and capacitors, which I'm not pleased at seeing.
Yeah, right. If you were to look at the mics you build and the improvements over the vintage versions, so they fall into a category, would you say we make the improvements because I'm trying to get this one particular thing, or is it just on a per mic basis?
It's absolutely on a per mic basis, and in some cases, trying to duplicate or get into the zone of the sound of an original microphone, and something that you can do technically to improve a specification might be independent of each other. So, for example, in the original 251, they used a capacitance multiplier on the heater. It's not crazy noisy, but there is a quieter way to do that. Mm. And it doesn't affect the tone of the microphone. So we did that a long time ago. There's in most vintage mics, you don't see a ton of a large grid resistor. And that affects the most bottom octave of something.
Mm.
And it's generally not noticeable on a vocal, generally. But it is noticeable on a drum set. So we opt for as full a bandwidth as possible so that the engineer can decide to take that out later. Because, and especially nowadays, it's very easy. Every digital device I've seen has a rumble filter that you can just engage.
Yeah, sure.
So I'd rather, if you need to take out the rumble and you don't want the low end, I'd rather you start out with it and decide. You make this decision later.
Yeah. You have a great homemade anechoic chamber here, and I know you test things to the nth degree, and I know that that's a big part of what you do, because you're coming from a very scientific place. That being said, before you release a mic, what kind of real-world testing do you have?
I will take it to the home studio,
mm-hmm.
and I'll give it a series of almost standardized tests that I do now.
Mm-hmm.
And it will get compared to other known microphones.
Meaning vintage mics? Or?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Vintage
okay.
mics I have.
What's your collection like?
It's not big.
Okay. Of course, you can easily get whatever you need anyway, I'm
yeah.
sure. So.
Yeah, pretty much.
And being just from people that you and I know we can pull all sorts of mics.
Well, there's usually whatever happens to be needed seems to be laying around anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's never a problem.
Okay. Last question. In your time doing this, it's not easy to run your own business, especially a boutique business. What's the best business advice that maybe somebody imparted to you, or maybe you learned along the way?
Well, that's, what an interesting question. I don't even know if the best business advice was ever anything anybody said to me. It might just be observations I've made of people who were successful, not only in my industry, but other industries. And from what I've seen, you have to, you really have to always push yourself and presume that you don't necessarily know how to do what the best possible thing that you could do, the highest quality product. And if you don't push yourself, you'll never see that you could have done better maybe, and somebody else already did. So you don't want to be that person. You don't want to get too... you don't want to get complacent and assume that you know everything at all. And And the successful people that I've worked for and seen in this industry allowed them, in spite of what people think, they allowed themselves to always be open to learning.
Well, it seems like a never-ending journey for you, because every time I talk to you, you tell me something new.
I know.
That you've learned, and consequently, I learned it as well.
I'll give you two stories, quick stories about that. Mm-hmm. Every time I've gotten a new pair of speakers for the living room, I said to my wife, I think we're done now. So your laugh tells the answer to that. And then it reminds me of a story of that Jim Keltner told me when we were out at his drum warehouse, and there was racks and racks of drum sets and cymbals. And he said, just when I thought I was over cymbals, somebody showed me a new cymbal. So, yeah, if you're interested in it, then and you can maintain your enthusiasm, you will learn something.
But that's the cool thing. In fact, everything is evolving still.
Yeah, well, one of the things that excites people most is discovery, just whatever it is. So that's why people develop new hobbies and forget the old ones, because they've stopped discovering in that hobby, and now they need not necessarily even hobby, but it could be what you work at.
Off the wall question. Well, maybe it isn't so off the wall. Microphone technology is more than 100 years old, basically. Do you see anything new on the horizon? Have you heard of anything new, revolutionary?
Yes, there's a $50 U47. No, we are in the reverse technology model, where eventually everybody figures out that nobody's really going to best what happened in Germany from 1950 to 1962.
Yeah.
And it's not, and I find this fascinating, because I read papers occasionally where somebody comes out and says, well, it's all just cultural conditioning. And I'm always humored by this, because at this point I'm 55 and I think I know why you're wrong. And I like your attempt to quantify it, but you didn't take everything into account. And the fact is that those things and what those mics sound like really do evoke the most emotional response from listeners, even if they were locked in a cave for the last 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. Why did the Germans get it so right? Was that luck? I mean, you know what? Because you figure that the sophistication of their gear, the sophistication in general of the technology.
Well, news flash that I have not seen this headline, but what was flat in 1955 is not flat now.
Yes, I remember
and
saying
all
yes.
That gear that was used to create devices back in the 50s. Has been replaced.
Yeah.
So as technology has marched on and created a new flat, the fact is that everybody keeps returning to what was flat in 1955.
Interesting.
So luck, I don't know, were they, you know, was post-war Germany hungry to achieve excellence, or to maybe just to feed themselves? Maybe. Maybe to prove something? I have no idea. Didn't get to meet enough of those old German engineers, so I don't have a ton of input to give you on that, why they got it so right. But given what everyone else has come up with so far, objectively, no one's really bested it. I mean, in some senses, maybe for classical music, yes, where you really are fighting hiss. Mm. On an old tube mic. And I can see that as an improvement that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, in most other musics, not really.
When you say that the flat from 19, from the 50s was different, to look at it on a graph, what does that look like?
Well, even though transistors were around, it was not common for measurement gear at the time. So the entire measurement chain was tube, and the loudspeaker was not comparable to anything we have nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that something about the faults in that gear then made for the combination of what people heard, because created that result, because they were completely engineering driven, and there's no way they ignored their measurements. They're too mathematically oriented. They didn't say, "Oh yeah, I prefer the sound of this one," despite what the chamber says. They listened to what their chamber said, and they proceeded from there.
But it can only be so good because of the, well, tubes, they change during the day when they heat up and cool off.
And we frankly don't know what it was like to have an all tube test setup. I can tell you that even with computers and transistors and things, and just air, things drift. You know, we could take three sensitivity measurements on an Omni mic in a better chamber than this, and we would get three slightly different measurements.
Interesting.
It's just air.
Well, humidity, sure.
That's why when you get into hardcore, the physics side of acoustics, those labs, they might even calibrate their mics in a gas other than air.
No kidding.
Sure.
Oh, it makes sense. Yeah, right.
And even though a lot of the air that we breathe now is nitrogen, it's still, there's a lot of other components and they vary.
Fascinating as always. This is great. Thanks, David.
Thanks for having me. And I always direct people to your webpage, because your insights into when you deconstruct hits with isolated tracks is always amazing.
They're fun, aren't they?
I tell everybody to go to the website.
Thank you.
For more information on Bock microphones, go to bockaudio.com. That's Bock Audio, B-O-C-K, audio, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.